I'm delighted to be able to introduce Ziggy to you. Ziggy, we are so grateful that you are giving us your time this evening. Ziggy has been part of the church here for nearly 20 years. It's a privilege. I had the privilege of taking Ziggy's wedding to Christiana at St. Michael's just 5 months ago. It was, I think, perhaps the craziest wedding I've ever been involved in. There were knife jugglers on unicycles and this sort of thing. It was excellent. But that's not what we're going to talk about this evening. Ziggy's story is fascinating, and I'm so glad that you agreed to come and talk to us. So, Ziggy, you've said to me that when you were growing up, it was inconceivable for you to believe in Jesus. Could you just say a little bit of why that was?
I grew up in a Jewish family. Both of my parents are Jewish. We used to keep the dietary requirements of the law. That's called keeping kosher. I used to go to, after regular school, we used to go to Hebrew classes 3 times a week, where we certainly learned a little bit of Hebrew, but mainly learned about Jewish traditions. And it's where I trained ultimately to have my bar mitzvah, which is like the coming of age ceremony. And then I went on to have my bar mitzvah in Israel at the Western Wall, and the family was there. I think maybe some of our Jewish identity is really wrapped up in my grandmother's story. People would call her a Holocaust survivor. She never was in a camp, but many of her family was. And her father basically saw the writing on the wall in 1939, and they obviously got the money together to get the paperwork together, the illegal paperwork together, so they could send their daughter away. I mean, she was 26 years old at the time. They were kind of children, were adults, apart from a younger brother who was about 18. But they said goodbye to her, and she made that difficult journey to England.
And she arrives in England, and then everything is okay?
Of course not. So her paperwork said she had to take up service working as a domestic servant for a family, and she did work for an English family in Hampshire. And so the family legend goes, on the very first morning, they asked her to cook bacon for the family. And if you know anything about Jewish people, you know we don't do the bacon. And my grandmother, she said, "Look, I'm sorry, I'm Jewish and I can't cook the bacon." But the family responded by saying they would make every single effort to have her deported. And she ran away from that home that very night. But that's not how she told the story. She said that a Christian family had wanted to deport her. See, from my grandmother's very narrow perspective, either you were Jewish or Christian, and this family clearly wasn't Jewish on account of the bacon. And when they wanted to deport her, it only proved that she really was, that the family really was Christian. I think that speaks of the them and the us that we grew up in. I was thinking, even when I was at school, I discovered that there were people called Christians. And they believed that Jesus was the Messiah. But it only served to remind me as a small Jewish boy that we were still waiting for the Messiah, and it wasn't Jesus.
Thank you. And your story, even your name, is this right, is connected to Jewish suffering. So to give Ziggy his full name, this is Zygmunt Mark Rogoff. And in 1970, is that right? The right year when your parents were choosing your name, they chose for you a German name, which is not an easy thing, I imagine, in a Jewish family. But it's your great grandfather's name, yeah. Zygmunt. Just say a little bit again why his name, why that was important.
I mean, so really, my grandmother's father, he perished in the Holocaust. He's just one of the 6 million Jewish people who died. I mean, so my name really, in that some sense, speaks is a monument to the millions of Jewish people who died purely because they were Jewish. But as the firstborn grandson, it was, I think, my mother said it was a challenging move for her because what would extended family members make of having this boy, beautiful baby boy, with this very strange German name? But she, in the end, she did name me after her grandfather she never knew. And of course, it's not just him, it was his entire town. So in that town, All 885 Jewish people were deported from that town in North Slovakia on trains directly to the gates of Auschwitz, down steps into to rooms, and died that way. So my name is just a testimony to horrible suffering.
And as you're growing up in the 70s, 80s, this is not past history. This is living reality.
I mean, we think of the atrocity, the tragedy the other day in Pittsburgh. I mean, it's not like Jewish people need to be reminded that these things can happen. It's just in the mindset, and then you get a tragedy like that that just affirms everything that Jewish people, as we, fear as a minority group. Because I think what we do think is the Holocaust is just an ongoing thing in our mind. This is what Europe did to us Jews. I think that really does describe it.
But not just Europe, Christians, again, well, in your grandmother's... Yeah. So to leap ahead in the story, when you then came to your parents to say you thought you were becoming a Christian, how did you do that?
Well, first of all, I didn't tell my mother. That was important. So I did wait a couple of years, and then I went away with my father for a weekend so I could tell him. It was very hard to tell him, and the only way I could really to do that was to... There's a video made about Holocaust survivors who've made a decision to follow Jesus, and I showed him one of the powerful testimonies there, in some sense to help him realize that if this woman who'd endured the concentration camps could believe in Jesus, then maybe we could too.
Thank you. So let's come back in the story then. I'd love us to understand how that sort of wall of it would be impossible for you to even look at Christian things ended up with you saying you're a believer in Jesus. So we need to come in the story. So Ziggy is a student. So he's now a PhD student at Nottingham University doing his PhD in mathematics. And you landed a job as a hall tutor, which is basically free accommodation if you look after the younger ones. And there in the hall is one other old man. So he's just come back from Russia. You're about to go to Russia for a year of postdoc study, and you're together in this hall full of young people. You become friends. You start talking. And then it was when he, later in London, when he became a Christian, that, in fact, he invited you to one of these evenings here.
Exactly.
And you even ended up, I don't know if you walked over to the table, but you ended up doing the Christianity Explored course. We obviously changed nothing in 20 years. We're still, it's all the same. You ended up doing that and looking at Mark's gospel. So what was it about that friend and talking to him? What was it about that made a difference?
I think it's just the nature of having friends you really get on with. You talk through many, many things. I think conversations with him really shifted my thinking away from being an atheist more to being an agnostic, primarily because if God existed, he'd have to make the first move. He would have to communicate with us. And since we saw no evidence that he had communicated, then we were in the dark. We were ignorant, and so we were. We expected him to make that move, and we hadn't seen it. But the issue is, why did I really then begin to say, to come to an event? I think it's because, if only for a moment, my blind spot, it disappeared. I didn't have that prejudice against Jesus, because somehow the friendship with my friend just allowed me to participate with him. Though, of course, we have to be honest, when he did tell us that he became a Christian, we thought he had gone completely mad. That goes without saying. But... we thought, intellectually, we thought, what are you doing, like committing intellectual suicide? But he made a bold statement, didn't he? And he invited me along, knowing I'm Jewish.
And when you then took away Mark's gospel, you were reading about Jesus. You've called that meeting a Jesus you never imagined. That's where we've... What was it you discovered about Jesus?
I mean, just reading the first couple of chapters of Mark's gospel, really I'm looking at Jesus' power, his authority, he's raising the dead, he's calming a storm with the word, and I'm thinking maybe Jesus could be the Messiah we were taught about in synagogue as children. But then I thought, how can I possibly believe that Jesus is the Messiah when the rabbis have been rejecting Jesus for the last 2,000 years? And I definitely got stuck at that point.
And what did you do about that then? Where did you take that?
Well, wonderfully, somebody gave me a book called Betrayed, which I bought a pile of these books today.
Just as it happens.
And it's about a very successful American Jewish businessman, a well-respected member of his Jewish community and synagogue. And one day, the daughter rang home from university and said she had some news. And of course, the family's nervous. And she says, "I believe in Jesus." And the family is upset. They're horrified. And above all, they felt betrayed. I mean, like all parents, there's no sacrifice they hadn't made. And now she goes and believes in the one we're not supposed to believe in. But the family, they decided the best thing to do to help their daughter was to read the New Testament themselves to show their daughter where she'd gone wrong in her thinking. They must have thought that, you know, the New Testament was probably something like Mein Kampf. And they just thought, we'll just work it out. This will be very simple. But they read it, and they discovered a Jesus they never could have imagined. Without ruining the story, because I do want you to buy the book. They all came to believe in Jesus, and he really had two very strong points he communicated. The first is that you can be Jewish and believe in Jesus. This is not an obvious point for many Jewish people. Or that, put another way, you don't cease to be Jewish when you believe in Jesus. I mean, if Jesus is the Jewish Messiah, then the most natural thing for a Jewish person to do is to come to their Messiah. But the thing that the book really concentrated on was prophecies in the Hebrew scriptures about the coming of the Messiah. Of course, there were hundreds of them, and I didn't know that. So what I really began to do, I began to look at these prophecies and really think about them.
And what did you find?
Well, I came to realize that Jesus hadn't just come to heal the sick and raise the dead. He'd come to do something far more incredible, that the Son of God had come from heaven to earth to die, taking the punishment for my sins, that I could be forgiven, not because of anything I had done, but because of what he had done.
And you talk about your two dominant emotions in that time when you're thinking you're going to become a Christian. You talk about joy and fear. What
I would almost say it's the very moment. I remember I was praying, and somehow it was in this very prayer I came to understand something of the gospel I never understood before. Joy, I mean, joy was filling my heart because Jesus is the Jewish Messiah. The wait was over. But the other emotion I experienced, and I didn't see it coming, and that's what really surprised me, is I began to experience fear. Because for the first time in my life, I realized that I'd never honored God as my King, Creator, and Sovereign Lord. I'd only ever lived for myself, with me at the center. And the thing that hit me next was I realized I'd done many things which I realized were now very, very shameful. They hadn't bothered me before, but they bothered me then. But the thing that really disturbed me was my attitude. My independent attitude, what the Bible would call sin. And that's when the penny dropped, as I began to suddenly realize that I'd focused all of my energy on the identity of the Messiah, looking at all these prophecies, was he the one? That I'd almost overlooked his mission. And the question, why do we even need a Messiah? And that's when I realized that the Son of God had come from heaven to earth to die, taking the punishment for my sin, that I could be forgiven.
Thank you. So yeah, I've got one more big question really for you. And that's more about what you now do, how you spend your life. So you now work for an organization that means you spend your life trying to persuade Jewish people to become believers in Jesus. And it strikes me there must be easier ways you could live your life. So if this is the community that you grew up in, you belong to, you've described for us something of how a Jewish person might feel being approached by you to talk to them about Jesus. And why would you put yourself through that? What is it that makes you think that's worth giving your life to?
There is only one way for people to have a relationship with the living God. Our sin simply prevents us from being friends with God. I mean, actually, the Bible would say that we're enemies of God. But wonderfully, God has done something remarkable for us. The Hebrew scriptures make it abundantly clear that we have a tremendous problem, but also presents a remarkable solution, that God would send his son into the world to suffer and die for us, taking that punishment upon himself. And of course, Jewish people don't know this. I wasn't brought up with this kind of information. Maybe the idea that, I mean, in terms of things that really shape my life, two things really shape my worldview today. One is the systematic death of 6 million of my people during the war. We call it the Shoah or the Holocaust. And the other is the death of our brother, the Messiah, Yeshua, Jesus. Together we're looking at Jewish suffering here. For one, we're looking at people who, both of them suffered remarkable injustice. They were spat upon, abused, and treated awfully. And for some, they were led to ravines and shot en masse. And others were pushed into buildings, church buildings, and set on fire. And others were pushed into small rooms and gassed to death. And for him, they crucified him. They tortured him. But we mustn't somehow think that the suffering of one overrides the suffering of the other. We can't somehow look at the Holocaust and think that that's the reason we can't share Jesus. And so actually, as a Jewish man who believes in Jesus saying, yes, of course, the Holocaust is a horrific tragedy, but we can never use that as an excuse never to share Jesus, because Jesus is our Messiah. And if in some small way I can communicate to Jewish people that they can have a great hope as they trust in their Messiah, then I'm doing a great job, I think.
See, thank you very much. It's been wonderful having this short chance to talk to you. Ziggy's sitting here at the front. You'll be here all evening, wait, so please do go and talk to Ziggy. He'd love to sell you a book, if nothing else. And we'd love to talk. I'd like to thank Ziggy again for what I can't actually see where he's gone. Where is Ziggy? I forgot to say that. Could we give Ziggy a round of applause? Thank you very much for... Ziggy, thank you very much. What I want to do now for something like half an hour maybe is to ask how much what Ziggy says matters, really. How much does it matter? Ziggy says he now knows a Jesus who he never imagined. Ziggy says he looked into the real historical evidence, into the Hebrew scriptures, and he now has a more accurate understanding of Jesus. But so what? Why does that matter? And I want to look together at a short paragraph from the life of Jesus that Ziggy took away from an evening like this and read 15 years ago. And I want to show you why Jesus thinks that it matters, what you do with what we've heard this evening. And perhaps that would be a shocking suggestion for you. I was at a very pleasant evening recently, a very nice meal that I've been invited to with some very excellent dinner companions, and one in particular, a very intelligent, successful man, had a very interesting career, and we got to talking about Jesus over this supper. And my companion, he had been a committed atheist since childhood, but he was open-minded about that, and we talked about what it would mean if he was wrong. And he was open to that idea, maybe there is a God, maybe he'd been wrong. But he said, it doesn't matter. Jesus and God, Jesus is all-loving. He won't mind. Won't matter what I've thought of him in my life, what I've said of him and thought about him. And as we talk more, we were sort of crammed in on a bench and talking. He said, are you really saying that God will take into account my opinions and my choices now in this life? And it was one of those conversations where the right answer is so obviously telegraphed to you, in that he is going to be completely astonished if the answer is not the one that he's expecting. Are you really saying God will take into account my opinions and my choices now? Yes. Yes, that's what I tried to say that evening, and that is what I think Jesus will say and what we're going to look at. The short paragraph we're going to look at in honor of Ziggy and his mother, it is all about the mother of Jesus. So if you would please turn to page 9 initially, and actually the paragraph we're mainly going to be in is on page 10. But we'll start on page 9. The person of Mary, the mother of Jesus, I think wonderfully, if shockingly, illustrates the answer to our question. How much does it matter, my opinion of Jesus? If Ziggy had not believed in Jesus, had never believed in Jesus, if the Jesus who you imagine is not in fact the real Jesus, how much does that matter? And the introduction, if you like, is the middle paragraph on page 9. It starts at the verse number, verse 20. When Jesus went home, the crowd gathered again so that they, Jesus and the disciples, could not even eat. And when his family heard it, they went out to seize him, for they were saying, he is out of his mind. See, the family of Jesus, they see Jesus' crazy life, as they think of it, and they draw a strong conclusion from that. Jesus, he is out of his mind. And if you turn the page to page 10, you'll see what a loving, caring family does when they come to that strong opinion about you. They care about him, so they decide to do something about it. Verse 21 says they set out to seize him. And in verse 31, his mother and his brothers came. And standing outside, they sent to him and called him. And if we were to update that slightly in modern terms, this is the conversation you might have. It's, come on, Jesus. You've had a sort of a hard time, haven't you? You've been a little bit overwrought. It's all going to be all right now. Come with me. There are men outside with a special coat for you to wear, and we're going to take you away until you feel better. Jesus, Mary and Jesus' brothers, they do what you would do for someone whose life is out of control and you think they need help. Now, how will Jesus respond to his mother? How will he respond to his mother and her opinion of him at that moment? And do you see what I mean? That she is a wonderful illustration for us, or a worked example for us, because she is so amazing. So Ziggy's background is utterly Jewish, but he is not more Jewish than Mary, who is the ultimate Jewish mother, if you like, and utterly devoted to her God throughout her life. If I can bring in my background slightly, as someone who grew up as a Roman Catholic, the shock of this, well, for starters, Jesus having brothers, that's a bit of a shock if you were brought up as a Roman Catholic. I don't know quite how that happened. But the shock of Mary, even temporarily, getting Jesus wrong. Seriously wrong. That was a huge shock for me. And just as Ziggy is not actually more Jewish than her, I certainly was not more Catholic than the Blessed Virgin Mary. And she's the supreme Jewish mother. She's acting because she is concerned that her boy is not able to eat. You know, this is almost straight from a sort of Woody Allen film, this, isn't it? In terms of cultural references. And she is the focus of Roman Catholic devotion. She is the closest it's possible to be to Jesus in terms of connection and knowledge and background. Her past faith in God could not be more impressive. When an unmarried teenage girl in a very, very conservative culture is asked the question, are you willing to have God's baby? She says yes, and takes the consequences. And also, if you think about it, her religious experiences, they beat anybody who's here this evening, I suggest. And I say that without knowing many of you in the room here. We're a little bit early for Christmas carols, aren't we? But angels singing and visiting her personally, a miracle star and kings coming to visit her child.
And that's even before we've talked about the whole miracle pregnancy and how that happened. She's Mary. And yet, on this occasion, she got Jesus wrong, seriously wrong. She thought that he was mad. And the question would be, surely, is that okay? Is that okay for her? She's Mary. And if it would be okay for her, if there's a way for Mary to be accepted while getting the identity of Jesus wrong, well, then maybe there is a way for people like me and people like you. Or if I could put that another way, the other way around, if it turns out there is no way for Mary to be accepted while she gets the identity of Jesus wrong, well, then there is no way for anybody to be accepted. So Ziggy is not more Jewish, I'm not more Catholic, you are not more spiritual than her. And what I want to do, I want to look at the conversation Jesus has with her and draw out three important lessons from how Jesus responds to his mother, and then hand that over to you for further discussion. So the first thing I want us to see is that Mary was rejected at this point by Jesus. Mary was rejected. So verse 31 and 32, look down, and I think it doesn't take, well, for me, it doesn't take any imagination to think myself into the story. This is for you if you have any kind of embarrassing teenage moment with your parents at all. Jesus is teaching. He's in the room doing his thing, and they come in and say, Jesus, sorry, your mum's here. It's time to go. Your mum's outside honking the horn. It's time to go. And I wonder what you'd expect Jesus to say. Maybe 5 minutes more and then I'll go. Maybe you could just tell her to come in and wait, and I'll be with her in a second. I don't think anyone was expecting what he says in verse 33. It's so shocking, I think, that most people I know sort of re-edit it, redub it in their heads. He says, verse 33, "Who are my mother and my brothers?" And he is not confused. He's not asking a question about who this person is that's come to the door. No one in the room is confused about what he's saying. Remember, they live in a society where the ties of blood and family are far stronger than certainly in the recent history here in London in the UK. He says to Mary and his brothers, "Who are you?" He's denying their existence. He's denying his family. He's saying, you are not my mother. And actually, there's still worse to come. So Jesus says, you are not my family. And then verse 34, looking about at those who sat around him, he said, here are my mother and my brothers. So on that occasion in Jesus' life, Mary was rejected, and then she was replaced by Jesus. And there is no stronger rejection, is there, than to replace something. I don't know what you are affectionate about. I loved my old car, my Ford Focus, but on the day when it broke down irretrievably, someone laughed at that. It was a very good car. So on the day when it broke down irretrievably in France, and they said le transmission over the phone to me about it, I left it in France, still there, and bought a replacement. Or more seriously, the teenagers in the soaps or the gossip columns each day, you may break up with a boyfriend or a girlfriend, but it's not really over, is it, until the day you walk into the Old Vic with the replacement. That's what really says what's happened. So Mary is rejected and replaced, and we need to know why this matters so much. And I think that's the second point here we need to say, is that the identity of Jesus is absolutely crucial for all human beings. To get Jesus wrong is not like having an interesting opinion on a historical figure. And that is because of what Ziggy explained to us tonight from the Hebrew Scriptures. God sent Jesus from heaven to earth to save us. And the Christian claim is that Jesus is not dead. He was briefly, but he is not now. And you and I will meet him on the day when we die. And to get his identity wrong is like mistaking the fire service coming to rescue you for a burglar. You can imagine doing that, can't you, as you wake from sleep and kind of battering away the people come to rescue, or like a door-to-door salesman. No, thank you, not today. I don't want that. And sending the fire department away. Here in this passage, we're given options for who Jesus might be in Mark chapter 3. And they're good options. I'd like to recommend them to you for your discussion and thoughts. Mary and the brothers, they think he's mad. If you were to look back the one page, you'll see in verse number 22 that the scribes from Jerusalem, they say he is possessed by Beelzebub. If you're not as up on Hebrew scriptures as you might be, that's a bad report. Okay, that is not 5 stars on Uber to say that. Jesus is Satan, is their opinion. He's evil. And then there is Jesus' own opinion and Mark's opinion. There in verse 11 from the most ironic group possible. Whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, "You are the Son of God." There are three utterly different ways to see Jesus. Is he mad? He claims to be God, and we would normally have a very straightforward approach to people like that. We'd say it's not safe for those people to be out in public. Certainly, we wouldn't go to them looking for advice. And his crazy life and his crazy claims, to some extent, back up that idea and show you why they thought that. Satan, as an option, you'd think perhaps is an even closer fit because of his power. Again, Ziggy mentioned that was the first thing that struck Ziggy from reading Mark's gospel. Everywhere Jesus goes, he is able to do things that no human being should be able to do. And things that, if you'd been there at the time, would have been utterly impossible to fake. So Jesus goes to the funeral of a 12-year-old girl in full swing. Everyone knows the family, the people. Everyone knows that she's died, and he stops her from being dead. And every day from then on, for the rest of her life, she's playing in the town square and presumably marrying someone who's in the village and going to work for someone else maybe. And every day there's this evidence that something very strange and powerful happened that day. Or there's the man who was blind his whole life until he met Jesus. And there's no faking the difference that short meeting with Jesus made. You can see why, as a sort of spin strategy, the scribes say we've got to acknowledge his power. Maybe it is evil power, the kind of power you should run from and stay well away from. Before I get to the God option, which I hope you'll know is the one I'm rooting for, do you see the fourth option, which is not there, which is the one that I grew up with, which is of Jesus the Englishman? It's no surprise, actually, that it's not obvious to the Jewish community that Jesus is Jewish, when I think certainly in this country we've spent hundreds of years trying to reshape Jesus as the most English person ever, by which I mean sort of wet and ineffectual and polite and English and the sort of person you might go to for some advice. I think that's how most of my friends think of Jesus. Pleasant, maybe good for some wise advice. Certainly not the sort of person who will mind what you thought of him in your life, the choices you made about him. No one who met Jesus thought that about him. Not one of them. Or not for more than 5 minutes, as they actually met him and engaged with him. And if you were to go and see the two at the back and sign up for that course and spend a few weeks looking in depth at what Jesus said and did in Mark's gospel and talking to other people about it, I think you'd find him unsettling and surprising and certainly not the sort of person you'd want to have as a sort of gentle Jesus, meek and mild advisor I go to every now and then. It's as if Mark is deliberately recommending the other two options. If you don't want to believe that Jesus is God, well then, can I suggest you either think he's a lunatic, or you think that he is one of the most evil people who ever lived. He has these crazy claims, unless, of course, they are actually true. And he has this amazing power, except everywhere he goes, he uses it for good. Even at the cost of his own reputation and life and freedom. And he is very demanding, which is why I think he cannot be the nice Englishman. He says, follow me. Submit your life to me. So Mary does not have a sort of interesting second opinion about her son. She wants him to deny his self-identity. She wants him to stop doing the work that he says God, his Father, has sent him to do. And she wants him to submit to the family and come and do what they want instead. She has rejected him. And actually, with someone of this status, Jesus, the Son of God, sent into the world to rescue us, to deny that is actually a rejection of him and of the mission he came to accomplish on your behalf. The identity is crucial. And notice, it's not a sort of technical, theological expert kind of question, this one we're talking about. It is a human, relational question. This book, Mark's Gospel, it puts you in the room with Peter, the disciple Peter. Mark wrote up Peter's memories and teaching and an account of Jesus' life. And Peter was in the room when they came in and said, your mum's here, time to go. And Peter's jaw would have been on the floor as Jesus said, that's not my mother. And Peter has put this here because he wants to help us get to know Jesus, the person who turned his life upside down. And really, this book is one of the dominant threads through it is Peter trying to get his head around who Jesus is, the identity of Jesus. And Peter writes himself into the story at key moments, putting his foot in it, or getting it wrong, or having his understanding changed. And let me suggest, you're used to coming to opinions about people. It's probably something that you're very good at. You make decisions about who to trust and who to work with, who to work for, who to employ, who to marry, who to buy a house. All sorts of decisions you make based on people and what they're like. Well, read this book and ask all of the same questions about Jesus. Does he seem mad to you? Does he seem evil to you? Well, he can't be a nice prophet given the things he says and does, but could he be who he claims to be? Could he be God come to save you? So Mary is rejected because the identity of Jesus is crucial, but that is not the end of the story here. So third point is that here in this account of Jesus and his mother, relationship is offered. So our third point, relationship is offered. So verse 34, verse 35 again on page 10. Who does Jesus replace Mary with? He looked around at those sat around him and he said, here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does the will of God, he is my brother and sister and mother. And the shocking word there is whoever. The will of God in Mark's gospel is laid out clearly in Jesus' teaching. It is a command to turn from our old way of life and to turn to Jesus and trust in his offer of forgiveness and eternal life. That's what it means. That is what God wants you to do. And if we do, whoever we are, well then, brother or sister or mother, we could be family with the Son of God. And that is a truly astonishing idea, I think, in context of some of what we've talked about this evening. By right, Ziggy is, 12 million miles closer to the throne of God than I am. In the teaching of Jesus, the right language here is child and dog. That's the difference in terms of what you'd expect coming into this story between a Jewish person and a Gentile person. And yet, here Jesus offers family status to anybody. And I don't know what your previous opinion of yourself was before you arrived tonight. I don't know what your self-opinion of you and Jesus would have been. My impression would have been very, very far from the biblical picture. I don't think the Catholic priest at my church, I don't think Father Jervis ever said this, or I don't think any of the Church of England churches I ever went to ever said this, but I had absorbed a sort of pecking order in which I was very close to Jesus and other people were not. And that was for a whole host of reasons, all mixed in to do with my religious observance and my family history and my spiritual experiences. But there's no way I had more to claim than Mary. And if there is no way for her, apart from accepting Jesus on his terms, well, then there was no way in for me. I needed to turn from my old way of life to Jesus and trust in his offer to forgive me. But turn that on its head, and wonderfully, if anybody would do that, whoever they are, whatever their racial background, family backgrounds, whatever they have done, however far from Jesus and God you think you are, Jesus says, do you want to come and be Mary? Doesn't he? Would you like, please, to come and be my mother, or my brother, or my sister? And just as we're closing, some of the what's wonderful about that, all of the potential barriers between me and Ziggy, and we've talked about some of the ones to do with historical mistreatment, sometimes in the name of Jesus, tragically, awfully, or any of the barriers between me and anybody else, they all come down at this point, don't they? Because Jesus is so far over the top in his generosity. No one is accepted on sufferance here. Maybe you think in Jesus' way of understanding there'd be some people who are better than others. That was the exhausting side of my religious observance, always trying to be in the top 10%. And I was allowed bacon, so that, I don't know how that worked out. But come and be my family, because I died for you, came from heaven to earth to die for you. And Mary herself, let's finish with Mary. Mary, we know from the rest of the story that she changed her mind, that she came to understand even the death of her son, and she came to understand his identity, his place in God's purposes. What would she say to us this evening? Well, no way, even for her, without a humble recognition of who this person really was, who Jesus really is. Your choices, your opinions of Jesus now, they matter. His opinion is crucial. Come and see what I ended up believing, she'd say, that he is God's son. And then come and share my closeness with Jesus. Come and be like a mother or a brother to him.